and Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Hi, this is Eva Herr, and welcome to my show tonight. Thanks for taking the time out of your schedule to be with us. Tonight I have with us Dr. Jim Roach, and we're going to talk about, just across the board, a lot of things to help you at home with various issues in your health using holistic medicine. So thank you, Dr. Roach, for taking the time to be with us tonight.
It's my pleasure, Eva. Thanks.
Thank you. And if you don't mind, if you'd just take a few minutes and tell my listeners who you are and what it is that you do, where they can find you.
Sure, Eva. I'm one of the leading integrative medicine experts in the country and one of the top two or three botanical medicine experts, that is, doctors that actually use botanicals in their practice. For 20 years, I tried to put patients on more and more medicine to get them better. But when I turned 50, I wanted to see how long, how well I could live. And I've attended 35 national conferences and learned that there are causes and cures. And now I'm trying to pull patients off medicines as fast as I can. I was trained at, initially I went to undergraduate at Duke University. I did medical school at the University of Kentucky and got family medicine certification in Tallahassee. And I'm board certified in family medicine and also in integrative holistic medicine.
And where can people find you?
Yeah, so my website is The Midway Center, T-H-E, themidwaycenter.com. And then you can punch the Contact Us key and leave a message, and I'll be happy to send you back a patient handout on virtually any topic that you're interested in. So be sure and send me an email, and I'll send you a handout on the area of your concern.
Now, I know that it's quite a ways away yet, but you're working on a book that people need to look out for over the next few months. Can you tell us just what you expect that book to be? I know you probably don't even have a title for sure yet, but...
Well, Eva, it's touched me so much to be able to help people with brain disorders, and particularly children with brain disorders, from autism to ADHD. For example, I had a mother who traveled several hours to bring a child with ADHD to my office this summer, and when she came back a month later, asked how the child was doing, she said she doesn't have ADHD anymore, following the nutritional recommendations, the nutrients that we recommended, and using a couple of botanicals, her ADHD went away. We had a child with autistic disorder, and over 2 years, she was severe originally, just screeching and totally uncontrollable and no communication at all, and now she's mainstream. She's getting 100 on her spelling tests and can communicate again, and when you see these outcomes, you feel compelled to do something about it. We need to get the word out as much as we can, but also I had a Parkinson's patient recently, and on follow-up visit, first follow-up, his cognition was significantly better, and he said, "You want to watch me walking in the hall?" And I said, "Well, okay, if you insist." And he literally jogged down the hall and back to show how much his mobility had improved. So the book is Healing Autism to Alzheimer's, Stories of Healing, Lessons for a Vibrant Mind, because the lessons that these patients teach us, we can all utilize to improve our brain health.
Well, why don't we just start your interview right there? And give me a note, and I just want to say for my listening audience, even though Dr. Roach is a physician, neither one of us are attempting to treat or diagnose you or the person that you care about. The information that we're sharing with you tonight is exactly that information. Take what we talk to you about, go into your homework, and go and see your own physician, or maybe perhaps contact Dr. Roach. So give us an idea of what you would do for a child that has ADHD.
Well, first of all, nutrition is the beginning spot, because 50% of brain disorders in children is just nutrition. And partly it's due to the issues we have in this country now with leaky gut. All of us have leaky gut issues, so every child that I test for food sensitivity issues has severe food sensitivity issues. Cow's milk products, usually to eggs, frequently to grains. And so we get all of our patients, actually children and adults, off of all cow's milk products, off of all grains, including oats and rice. And the only exception to that maybe would be underweight individuals where we might allow rice still in the diet. And obviously processed foods, anything that converts into sugar, white potatoes, too much fruit, high sugar fruits, all can be problematic. But altering nutrition is 50% of the battle. If you get that accomplished, you see dramatic improvement frequently within just days. But then there's a next level, of course, you doing testing, finding answers. You know, we have access to a wealth of tests that are affordable and can give us valuable information. We can look at genetic testing. We can look at micronutrient testing. You know, check every single vitamin, key minerals, amino acids, nutrients. And then also, in some situations, particularly in older individuals, look at heavy metal levels, look at homocysteine levels, look at hormonal imbalances, which in my practice, half of our patients, well, more than half, have substantial hormonal imbalance with too much estrogen, not enough testosterone.
So I want to go there too. There's so many questions I'm going to have. So, but before we move from ADHD, what do you think the role, if any, of fatty acids is?
Oh, fatty acids are huge. Omega-3 fatty acids are essential. And so I put every patient on omega-3 fatty acids. Now, that said, if you have individuals who are going out and eating fast food or have other detrimental habits, adults that, you know, drink alcohol or smoke, then, yeah, they might convert those healthy fatty acids into harmful ones. But correcting those habits, then the omega-3 fatty acids are essential. Other essential nutrients for brain health, for example, in children, ADHD, you know, vitamin D, very, very important. And I'm more aggressive in my supplementation with vitamin D. But getting into the hormonal issue a little bit, almost all of us have too much estrogen, not enough testosterone. And estrogen promotes inflammation in excess. Think of lupus. When you give estrogen in lupus, it makes it worse. Well, it turns out we all have autoimmune issues. And the higher estrogen levels, then the more inflammation we have. And guess where estrogen comes from? Partly from certainly chemicals that act like estrogen in our body, but in fat cells. We convert testosterone to estrogen. So as we eat more processed foods, as we get less physical activity, we have higher estrogen and lower testosterone. That estrogen in excess, think of PMS symptoms, promotes anxiety, panic, obsessiveness, whereas testosterone dampens autoimmune activity and inflammation. It strengthens the immune system. So getting enough testosterone and keeping estrogen in check while keeping that testosterone from going to that more powerful dihydrotestosterone that can make people aggressive and bossy and arrogant and lead to prostate problems. So that balancing is key. So there are ways to do that botanically with children, because even children have these issues that are important to address.
So let me step back 1 second. I have one more question before we move on from the fatty acids. You said if you eat fast foods and take these fatty acids, you can convert them into the bad fatty acids.
Correct.
Can you just tell people what you're talking about? Because I don't know that everybody understands that, and most people are out there, you know, not really walking the line, because your body knows if you cheat, so you need to walk the line or you don't need to walk the line. And taking these fatty acid fish oils and things. So if they're not walking the line and they're taking fish oil, is that potentially harmful?
It is potentially harmful, because if you go out, if you take fish oil and go out and eat a fast food meal, then you're generating so much inflammation in your system that you're converting that healthy fat into a harmful fat. So I think you have to address overall nutrition and looking at that. Now, other key nutrients, incidentally, magnesium, very, very important, and also zinc, very important to address in children and really all of us, but especially in children. You know, magnesium calming, relaxing, a cofactor in serotonin production, so it helps with sleep at night. I like to use magnesium glycinate. The only side effect or contraindication is diarrhea because it has a laxative effect. And then, Eva, as you know, the B vitamins are so valuable. Folate, B6, B12 are key in the detoxification pathway, the methylation pathway that reduces inflammation, helps you get toxins out, and also optimizes production of SAMe, the fastest-acting natural antidepressant. So the B vitamins are critical. And where the commonality with so many of these nutrients is that they boost testosterone and lower estrogen. So vitamin D boosts testosterone, lowers estrogen. Magnesium boosts testosterone, lowers estrogen. The B vitamins help metabolize excess estrogen. So there's some common pathways, common themes that come into play.
You know, I don't think I realized that these things boosted testosterone, because now that you bring that up, I'd like to ask you a question that has been really kind of driving me crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I had a heart attack last year, and I got with Patricia Kane and Ralph Halsworth and got on a regimen, and something happened. I'd put on a lot of weight because I used to be like a pencil, and then all of a sudden all this fat, adipose, just appeared out of nowhere. Then I started this diet, and the weight melted off, but then I turned very hard underneath, like I work out in a gym all the time. And the only thing I can think of is the test that it converted to testosterone. Is that what happened? I mean, my abdomen is hard, my butt's hard, my legs are hard. I'm 53. And people think that I spend all day in a gym, and I don't.
Well, as you get rid of those fat cells, you've stopped converting testosterone to estrogen, so your natural testosterone levels rose, your natural estrogen levels went down to where they're supposed to be. And yes, your muscles respond to physical workouts in those situations.
I'm not doing physical work. I mean, I walk on a treadmill,
okay. Yeah.
And I work my property. But,
yeah.
I mean, you would think I worked out in a gym all the time. Is that what's happening?
Well, your muscle tone is better from the testosterone. I don't know if there are other factors at work or not.
Is that how that it happens, though? Because I didn't know why this happened. But my abdomen's hard as a board now.
Yeah,
it's crazy. So is that what happens?
And then I suspect you started some of these other nutrients that we were
talking about
as well.
I did. I take all of those things and more, quite frankly. Okay.
Yeah.
So I didn't realize that. So talk about, because I don't know all of the questions to ask exactly, since I wasn't prepared for that specific things I didn't know. But how does that happen? Which things support reducing estrogen dominance and your need for testosterone?
Well, I think it's key to understand that whenever you want to raise your estrogen levels, and I tell my male patients this, I say whenever you want to raise your estrogen, your female hormone, whenever you want to lower your testosterone, whenever you want to have brain fog and bloating, and joint aches and muscle aches, I say just eat sugar, eat anything that converts into sugar, processed foods, grains, white potatoes, too much fruit, high sugar fruit, and you'll get your wish. Your estrogen will go up, you'll get more anxious, your testosterone will go down. You know, testosterone promotes confidence. And so you have an option. And then, again, estrogen, by promoting inflammation, is a key factor with those aches and pains you get in your joints and muscles. So it may not be the primary cause, but it'll certainly aggravate that. So if you tune into your body, because these reactions are typically 2 to 12 hours after you consume those foods, if you just listen to your body, it will tell you when you've made a mistake. So the first thing, whenever you get an ache or pain, or whenever you get brain fog, think, what have I eaten in the last 2 to 12 hours that triggered that?
So you know, when I first met you, we had talked about my hormone levels, and I kind of imagine that many women have my same problem. My estradiol was almost non-existent. What is that? What does that tell us? And how do you go about raising that?
Well, estradiol is the main estrogen to support your brain and to support your heart. It's the one that raises HDL cholesterol, the good cholesterol. So, for example, I had my 8th grade girlfriend. She had severe chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia. She was in bed every day for 23 hours. She got out of bed 1 hour to take care of her invalid mother-in-law who had Alzheimer's. And she went to a major medical institution in the Northeast with a big reputation. She went three times. No one had any answers. But no one had checked hormone levels. And she had a zero estradiol level. She had zero on testosterone. So, of course, she didn't have it vitality. She felt like a robot just going through the motions. So when we addressed her hormone levels, when we addressed her food sensitivities and put her on supplements, she now lives a normal lifestyle. Now she can choose when to have fibromyalgia, where she goes out with the girls occasionally, and when she does, she knows she's going to ache a little bit more on those days, right? But she has that choice.
So what would someone look towards to do that, to raise their estradiol?
And it depends on the circumstances, but I prefer to use natural approaches first of all. I think there are times when you need to use actual hormone, and I would recommend in those circumstances using only bioidentical estrogen in a topical form, because it's much safer, healthier when you do that. But botanical approaches are the best way to start out. For example, shatavari, which is white asparagus, is very good in support of estrogen. And so using shatavari for support of estrogen, I use Vitex, chaste tree berry, in support of progesterone. And then there are any number of botanicals that support testosterone. For example, cordyceps, which is a mushroom extract, helps with that. So, you know, supporting all three is important. But if you don't get sufficient response, then that's where you would look at bioidentical estrogens. Now, how you get estrogen, if you do go that route, is very important, because if you take estrogen by mouth, it triggers inflammation. 85% increase in C-reactive protein. You also get an increase in sex hormone binding globulin, which binds up your testosterone and growth hormone and thyroid hormone. So all of those levels drop, and your risk for clotting triples.
Wow. So what is the difference between estradiol and estrogen? Because many women are going to say, well, I thought you said I was estrogen dominant, so why do you want me to raise estradiol? Could you explain the difference there?
So, right. I mean, most of us have too much estrogen, male and female, but some of us don't have enough hormones, period. And those the individuals who are very fatigued often are low on all hormones. There are three different forms of estrogen. Estradiol is the most important one. There's also estrone, which is actually the most active as far as impact on the sexual organs. And then there's also estriol, which is a very weak estrogen. It's particularly good in support for dryness in the vaginal area, for support of urinary symptoms, urinary incontinence in women, and also it supports skin health. So I often will use just low doses of estriol vaginal cream, maybe twice a week, to help with urinary situations, dryness, and the side effect is you get nicer looking skin. But balancing those, estrone I avoid as a supplement, because that one hits the sexual organs more than the other two do, therefore a higher risk for hormone-related tumors. But
which one was that? Say again, please.
Estrone. Estrone. It's the most powerful one in promoting hormone-related concerns like cancer.
Now, what about black cohosh? Is there a place for that? Many women take black cohosh. Is there a place for that here?
Black cohosh is particularly good for hot flashes. You know, originally it was used for rheumatism. That was the original indication. So you can use it for aches and pains or for muscle support, but later it was learned it was helpful for hot flashes. I mainly use it in that scenario.
What about pregnenolone? That's a hard word for me to say.
Right.
What does that do?
So pregnenolone is the mother hormone. So all hormones come from what? From cholesterol. So when you take medicines that lower cholesterol, what happens to hormones? They drop. They always drop. And so you automatically, if you're on, for example, a statin cholesterol medicine, your hormones are going to decline, and that includes pregnenolone, which is the mother hormone that all the others originate from. So pregnenolone is basically metabolized two directions. One, it can go to DHEA, and DHEA can convert into testosterone, and then testosterone is metabolized two directions, either into estrogen or into dihydrotestosterone, which is 5 to 10 times stronger than testosterone. That's the one associated with male pattern hair loss. That's associated with excess hair growth in undesirable locations. It's associated with aggressiveness, with arrogance, with prostate enlargement in men, and it's the main driver of prostate cancer as well. So you want to keep that one in check. Pregnenolone also is metabolized a different direction into progesterone, which is a precursor to cortisol, which supports adrenal function. So one way to understand it, you've heard the term adrenal fatigue, and a lot of people have heard that. And so part of the issue there is all the pregnenolone is going down the pathway to generate cortisol because of high stress levels. The body is pumping out adrenaline and pumping out cortisol to deal with stress. It has to survive. But since your pregnenolone is going that direction, then the pathway towards DHEA and testosterone and estrogen withers. And so you start to, all your organs start to atrophy. That means shrink. And they don't function as well. And so there are all kinds of ways to address that, by either with hormones or with botanicals that support the adrenals. You certainly can even use pregnenolone a little bit under physician or healthcare guidance.
So do men use pregnenolone who have pattern baldness?
I've not heard it used for that. Now, if we're...
I haven't heard it. It just was. Said you were talking about the pathway, so it just made me ask the question.
Right. Yeah. So the way to deal with male pattern baldness is to block testosterone to dihydrotestosterone, and there are lots of different ways to do that. Lots of nutrients that block that pathway. Well, zinc and green tea are two nutrients that I recommend virtually for all of our patients, because it blocks that pathway, and it also blocks the testosterone to estrogen pathway. So most of us need more testosterone, less estrogen, less diet or testosterone. Green tea and zinc are perfect for filling that need. Now, nutrients specifically blocking testosterone to diet or testosterone include salt palmetto, include lycopene from tomatoes, include nettles, N-E-T-T-L-E-S, so those are some good ones. Reishi, R-E-I-S-H-I, a mushroom extract, also blocks that pathway.
That's interesting. You know so much. I don't know if we're going to get it all in tonight. You're going to have to promise me that you come back.
Sure.
Okay. The next thing that I wanted to ask you about, I had a lady yesterday. I was shopping at Target, and she, I don't know how we were talking about. She was the lady that worked in the meat department and we're talking about grass-fed beef. And somehow we got off that she has MTHFR with CBS, and she has kidney problems. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
So
that CBS mutation?
Yeah, CBS mutation, right.
Yes. How do you support your kidneys if you have that? Because I told her I'd ask that tonight.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And if you don't know that, it's okay to say I don't know.
Yeah,
I
don't know that specific answer. You know, there are a lot of ways to protect the kidneys. Now, first of all, remember what I was mentioning earlier. You know, the kidneys are particularly impacted by testosterone. For example, cordyceps, the mushroom I mentioned, is great for supporting kidney health. In fact, you know, there's some evidence to suggest that maybe it could even regenerate the kidney.
Really?
Possibly the liver and the lungs as well. So supporting testosterone with botanicals and with nutrients supports kidney health and dampens inflammation, which aggravates kidney health. So I think that those are key strategies that I use. You know, fish oil is great for kidneys. Vitamin D is great for kidneys as well. Coenzyme Q10. Now, CoQ10 does drop blood pressure, so be careful if you're 90 over 60 and starting CoQ10. But those are all key nutrients. And nettle seed is maybe one of the best single nutrients for kidney health.
Okay.
But with the, you know, the methylation pathways, which you're getting into, you know, those pathways are key for detoxification, for dampening inflammation, and obviously that will impact every organ and every tissue in the body. So, you know, if you're able to do testing to identify what the issues are, because, yeah, I'm not sure what the incidence of that CBS mutation is, but, you know, 2-3% of the population,
or maybe quite high.
But, yeah, if you've got that issue going on, and maybe the way to know about that is, you know, how do you react to B vitamins? Do you feel worse when you take B vitamins? Do you feel worse when you eat cruciferous vegetables, onions, garlic? Those might be clues that you've got that issue going on. But doing testing to find out is really helpful.
So let's talk a minute about these B vitamins and the detoxing thing. Because I don't want people to run out there and suddenly start taking these methylated B vitamins without some kind of supervision, because I know from experience it can be quite terrible.
Yeah.
What exactly goes on? I mean, first of all, we need to let the people know why they need to take these B vitamins and why the methylated version of these vitamins are important, but we also need to tell them about the things to be careful of.
Right.
What does the folic acid, the folate, do? How does it release those toxins? And then is it the B12 that takes it away? Is that what's happening? How does that work?
Yeah, so folate is the most important driver of the methylation pathway for detoxification.
Let's assume first that people have no idea what we're talking about when we say methylation. What is that?
So first of all, it's important to get toxins out of our system. You know, each of us have, you know, hundreds of toxins in our bodies that we didn't even exist 60 years ago. So it's important to get those toxins out. And the most important nutrient in getting rid of those toxins is glutathione. Glutathione is like Velcro, attaching to heavy metals and other chemicals to take it out of the body. So it's important to manufacture as much glutathione normally as we can. And a key way in manufacturing glutathione is the methylation pathway, utilizing folate and B12, B6, and a few other nutrients. And folate is the most important one on that pathway. It's maybe three times more powerful than B12, which is maybe three times more powerful than B6. So the MTHFR mutation, which Eva, I think 70% of my patients have an important mutation on that pathway. So most of us have issues with that. And if we've got that mutation, we can't convert folic acid, which is not found in nature. It was patented back in the 1940s. So it's a chemical, in my opinion, not a vitamin. And so 70% of us can't fully convert that into folate, the key nutrient in that pathway.
I just want to make this very clear for folks, and I'm just a journalist, but it's my opinion that you're the expert here. Folic acid, if you have an MTHFR mutation, can be dangerous to you, right?
Exactly. Just like any other chemical, it can build up. For example, with breast cancer, it promotes breast cancer. Folic acid promotes. Because if you can convert it into folate, then it's toxic. But once you convert it into folate, if you get the methylfolate version, for example, then that helps get rid of estrogen metabolites to reduce breast cancer risk. So that's the most obvious example.
So people, the government started supplementing foods with folic acid in 98, if I'm not mistaken. So people are very confused. If our government's doing to this, shouldn't I take it? So it's not folic acid, but folate, right, that they need?
Right, and the reason the government did that is it's a very stable form from their perspective, that commercially it doesn't degrade very rapidly. So it's easy to use. It has a long shelf life, unlike the natural methylfolate. But the reality is you really want to get that active methylfolate instead for that pathway. Now, what you were talking about earlier is that you don't want to start, well, first of all, ideally assessing to see what your homocysteine status. That would be helpful in identifying it on a blood count. You can look at the size of your red cells. If they're bigger than normal, that could be a clue you've got some issues. Or ideally, even looking at the specific levels. There's a lab that actually I'm a consultant for nationally called SpectraCell that looks intracellularly at folate and B6 and B12 to determine where you are. And using that in conjunction with genetic analysis helps you determine what's best for you. But if you were to start supplementing on your own, you'd want to start maybe with methylcobalamin. That's the active form of B12. Start at very low doses. Maybe titrate that up to where you feel optimal. And then add in methylfolate and start at low levels and then titrate that up. That would be probably the best approach to go, because the problem is if you mobilize that pathway too aggressively, and depending on what your genes are, you mobilize too many toxins all at once, and as they're leaving your system, they can do damage.
I'm here to tell you that if you, I was confused about what my doctor told me to do at the very beginning when I started this, and I was taking 20 in the morning of 5-MTHF, that's the methylated form of folate,
yeah,
and 20 in the evening. I thought I was dying. I really thought I was dying. I had severe kidney problems. I hurt all over. So we're really serious people. Don't run out and start taking large doses of these things without your doctor. So that being said, what about folinic acid? Where does that fall into place, and what is that? How is it different, and is that safer to take, or why would you even consider folinic acid?
And
or would
my
you?
Understanding of folinic acid, and you might help me with your understanding as well, is that it's kind of an intermediary between folic acid and methylfolate. So it's better than folic acid, but it may be and is not quite as good in methylfolate, again, depending on what your genetic mutations are.
That's kind of what, I don't have a big understanding of it, but that's kind of what I thought.
Sure.
I don't know exactly what it does,
so
but I have noticed.
Methylfolate is better than folinic. With methylfolate, you're covered, but folinic, you may or may not be covered, and depending on your genes.
Okay. So we have about 20 minutes, and I want to give you a chance to talk about some things that you want to talk about, maybe Lyme's disease. I mean, I could talk about this other thing all night and hormones. So where do you think we
right.
need to go from here?
Well, I think Lyme disease is a good area to talk about. And my approach is a little different. So I think that may be helpful in understanding that, because there are basically two camps in terms of Lyme disease. Now, what are we talking about with Lyme disease? Well, I'm in Kentucky, and officially in Kentucky, there's not supposed to be much Lyme disease. But I'm here to tell you that I see 5 patients a day with Lyme disease. It's highly prevalent in Kentucky. And so what are the symptoms? How do you know that you have Lyme disease? Well, first of all, chronic fatigue is a common presentation for Lyme disease. And then also sensitivity to light or sensitivity to noise, and maybe even more specifically, visual focus. In other words, Lyme patients maybe one day are able to focus very well visually, and the next day they have trouble focusing their eyes. So that's very characteristic. They have typically migrating joint pains. They may experience palpitations, and they certainly can have other brain issues. Now, one thing that is very characteristic of Lyme, when you see it, are movement disorders, tremors, for example, or tics, which are kind of twitches. So what I'm finding is that most of my Tourette's patients, most of my Parkinson's patients, even most of my multiple sclerosis patients have Lyme disease as a contributing factor to that. And then if you address that, they do substantially better. So I was mentioning my Parkinson's patient who was jogging. What I figured out that he had Lyme disease. And what I find is one of the simplest things to help those individuals most of the time, and of course it depends on your genes, but most of the time B12 injections are very, very helpful for those individuals. It will buy them 3 to 7 days of energy. It promotes myelination of nerves, meaning that the sheath that covers nerves, which helps the conduction and function of those nerves, is promoted by B12. So I will start at very low doses of B12 injections and then have patients just titrate that up to where they're performing optimally. And they may start out with an injection once a week, and they may end up boosting the dose and taking it once a day. I'm fine with that if they're seeing good outcomes.
So is that why many people have, and I don't know the words for it, but tingling and numbness in their hands and feet because of demyelination, because
right.
of inability to methylate B12? Because from what I understand, many people who have this MTHFR thing have Lyme's, or there's some kind of connection with Lyme's.
Yeah, right. They would be more susceptible to the side effects of Lyme's and the symptoms of Lyme's. So yes, these what we call paresthesias or odd sensations, maybe burning sensations, tingling sensations, shooting pains that kind of come and go, that are variable from day to day, are often Lyme related. So in terms of assessing those individuals, I do two tests in looking at that. I do something called CD57, which is a test that's done by LabCorp, and currently most insurances cover most of the cost on the CD57. So it's a great screening tool. It's not perfect, but if you have an abnormal reading on the CD57, then the odds are 2 out of 3 that you have Lyme issues. And there's another test called iGenX, capital I, then gene, G-E-N-E, and then X, and that test is covered by Medicare. So if you're Medicare age, that test is free, and that's more specific for Lyme disease. And if that's positive, then the odds are like 95%. So that's how to kind of assess that.
How do you treat it?
So what I've found, Eva, you know, there are two camps. There's the conventional old camp that says, well, we'll give you a round of antibiotic, and that should eradicate
it. I don't even want to go there. I don't want to waste
right.
my minutes on my show.
Sure. And then the other camp says, well, you might need long-term antibiotic therapy, up to 2 years, because it's very difficult to eradicate. Now, I agree that it's very difficult to eradicate, but what I find is that by strengthening the immune system goes a long ways towards putting it into a dormant state so that it's just a passenger and so that it doesn't matter whether you eradicate it. So there are a lot of strategies and optimizing nutrient levels, you know, identifying deficiencies and addressing that. You know, I've got 2 vitamin D receptor mutations, so I'm on 15,000 units of vitamin D every day. Now, don't you take that much? Unless you have guidance from a practitioner, but I want those vitamin D receptors activated. That boosts testosterone, that strengthens the immune system. So key way, measure your testosterone level. Be sure you're getting that up in the mid-range of normal, and that tells you how well you're doing. But lots of botanicals support testosterone.
Like what? Give them some names so they can do their homework.
You know, so cordyceps supports testosterone. There was a tonic identified 300 BC, and the yaks in the high mountain plains of Tibet were frolicky and frisky, and they were eating these parasitic caterpillars that had mushrooms growing out of them. And so the Chinese women's national team used cordyceps to win the track and field competition, 1993 Olympics. Another one, passion flower, boosts testosterone, lowers estrogen, but yet hits the GABA receptors. GABA is a calming receptor in the body, so it's a great one to take at bedtime. Now, the side effect of that is you might end up having more sexual activity than you're used to. So that's a side effect that a lot of people can put up with. Ashwagandha, if you're not low on estrogen, is another one to look at.
Okay, I'm right. I'm taking notes.
Sure.
Okay. My next question. I wanted to tell you one thing that both my husband and myself use with for testosterone support is this product called Scott's Pine Pollen. And we get it from Woodland Essence, and I'm telling you, it really works. The only problem is that it's seasonal, so sometimes they run out at the end of the year, but it really, really works, and it's kind of cheap.
Yeah.
Okay, what else? Where do you want to go next?
Wow. So a key thing in understanding autoimmune disorders. So as I mentioned, we have an epidemic of autoimmune disorders, asthma, allergies, issues like MS are in epidemic proportions. And even when I find a key factor there is hormone imbalance and, again, food sensitivities. Food sensitivities affects everything because I don't know how well your audience is clued into leaky gut and all the complications of that. But
they should have an idea.
Sure.
Imagine.
Right.
But
so
any specifics you can give them to advance their knowledge would be great.
Yeah. So just as a reminder, you know, because of antibiotics, because of eating chickens that have been pumped full of antibiotic, in my opinion, genetically modified foods that damage the intestinal lining can then make it permeable to allow proteins to cross before they've been fully digested. The immune system sees those proteins and sends out antibodies thinking the body's being invaded. So those antibodies not only attack those proteins, but they attack any organ and tissue in the body that has those food proteins in them, which is probably most organs and tissues. But not only that, in your intestinal tract, you have bacteria that are like cats and dogs. They eat food and they excrete toxins. Normally those toxins pass out through the rectum, but with increased permeability, those toxins get in the bloodstream, and they're lipophilic. That's a word that means they're attracted to fat, and the fattiest organs are the brain, 70% fat, the breath, and nerve sheaths. So those toxins go in those locations, and the key thing is that genetically, we all have different abilities and how we can get rid of those toxins. So detoxification becomes very important, as well as, you know, avoiding getting those toxins in, eating organic, whole foods, local foods.
So can I go back, when we talk about toxins, it always takes me back to MTHFR, and it's such a new topic, I always have questions. When they talk about methyl donors, what does that mean? Do you need to take more? Like one of the things that people are taking are dimethylglycine because it's a methyl donor, or niacin because it's a methyl donor. What does that mean?
So methyl donors are a mechanism utilized in producing glutathione. So it's a process of where you take basic amino acids like methionine and convert it into acetonacyl methionine and then into glutathione. So you need methyl donors to do that.
Oh, okay.
So folate and B12 and B6 and trimethylglycine are all methyl donors. But depending on your genes, you know, you may not be able to use one of those pathways. So sometimes trimethylglycine works when your folate pathway is not functioning as well.
What about dimethylglycine?
So DI means it has two methyl groups instead of the trimethylglycine, which has three. So I prefer the trimethylglycine.
Okay. So we have about 8 or so minutes. Do you want to talk about gray hair, or what would you like to talk about?
Well, I think
we know so much.
Well, thank you. I will just mention, since you raised gray hair, I'll just mention a couple of things real quickly. First of all, the obvious things with gray hair, you know, if you eat poorly, if you stress yourself out too much, you know, you're going to age more rapidly, and that's going to be reflected in your hair color. But there are some nutrients that I'm personally finding might make a difference. Now, you want to balance these things when you utilize them. For example, astaxanthin, I think, is one of the things that is helpful for some individuals. Astaxanthin is in krill oil. It's what gives wild salmon its pink color. And it's a wonderful antioxidant, but it also blocks testosterone conversion to dihydrotestosterone. So it boosts testosterone some, and it sends some of that down towards estrogen, but not a lot of that. So it brings a good balance. But individuals that are what I would call estrogen dominant need to be a little cautious there, because they might get too much estrogen effect from astaxanthin. You know, reishi also, very similarly, blocks testosterone to dihydro and then shuts the metabolism of testosterone towards estrogen. Now, estrogen promotes hair growth. And so, you know, when you look at most of the nutrients that promote hair growth, they're working on that pathway of blocking dihydrotestosterone and increasing estrogen. And I find that a lot of the nutrients that help with limiting gray hair and even reversing a little bit the gray hair production work in those similar pathways. Almost all of them have a hormonal impact. Other topics, though, that we may want to think about, I see a lot of women with premenstrual issues, perimenopausal women, and that's a relatively easy thing to fix. Now, you know, when you're in your 20s and your 30s and you're ovulating routinely, you produce progesterone, the calming, relaxing hormone. And so you don't have so many issues with PMS, unless you're under a lot of stress and are not ovulating. But in the adolescent years and also in the perimenopausal years, for example, in the 40s, when you're 40 years old or 45, you don't ovulate every month and you don't produce that calming, relaxing progesterone. All you're producing is that stimulatory estrogen. And so what women get are anxiety, panic, obsessiveness, phobias, sleep disturbance, irritability, carbohydrate craving, swelling, breast soreness, tenderness, migraines, heavier periods, and cramping. But also they're getting autoimmune issues because estrogen's promoting autoimmune activity. So they get bloating, brain fog, aches and pains in their joints. So I don't care what symptom women are having, it's almost always worse the days before their period. But what I find is that 90% of the time, 90% of women, you can completely neutralize that. The key thing is to neutralize that excess estrogen. So I use a botanical called Vitex, or chaste tree berry, and I start around day 14 of the cycle. I will start one twice a day, one at bedtime and one about 12 hours later, which is usually about 30 minutes before lunch. And then around day 21, I'll bump it up to two twice a day. Day 25, up to three twice a day. Now, you could substitute progesterone cream over the counter. It will do about the same thing. But I find for 90% of women, that eliminates their PMS symptoms. Now, there are other strategies, too, because remember that nutrition influences your estrogen levels, so optimizing your nutrition, and also aerobic activity. Women who, for example, jog 25 miles a week may stop having periods because their estrogen gets so low, so aerobic activity helps keep that estrogen in check. Now, the caution is that 10% of women convert progesterone into testosterone, which can then get converted into estrogen, and they get stimulated by that, and it can have the opposite effect. So always listen to your body, you know, see how your body reacts to these types of interventions. But
actually, somebody just emailed me that a question about what you're talking about. They said that they have hair in inappropriate places.
Okay.
A woman's.
So, well, progesterone neutralizes both estrogen and also dihydrotestosterone. So it helps with excess hair growth. It helps with complexion issues, which are tied in with dihydrotestosterone. It helps with the aggressiveness that some women feel, you know, in those days before the period. So progesterone helps both that and also the stimulatory autoimmune symptoms tied in with estrogen. So now what I typically like to do is, in combination with Vitex, I will use rhodiola rosea. So I don't suspect you're familiar with rhodiola. It's a terrific adaptogen. The only cautions with rhodiola, if you're bipolar, it can make you a little manic. It has a drying action to it. But I will have women begin on day 14 taking some, or maybe even day 7 or 8, rhodiola, maybe 250 milligrams 30 minutes before breakfast, and around day 14, bump it up to twice a day, 30 minutes before breakfast and lunch, and that helps your mood, keeps your mood upbeat, keeps your focus. So in combination with Vitex or progesterone cream, those two are dynamite in my clinical experience. But yeah, the progesterone also, incidentally, blocks, you know, the receptors in the breast to prevent overstimulation of the breast and the ovaries. So it, in my opinion, it protects against hormone-related tumors.
That's amazing. So did we cover what to do to help the men that have not enough their sex hormones? Did we? I know we talked about it, but did we do a good enough
job? So with men, well, let's talk about men for a minute.
And we have about 6 minutes till we're over. So I want you to talk about it, but I also want you to keep a minute or two at the end to tell people again where they can find you. Tell them if you take phone consults and things like that, okay?
Okay, sure.
So you got the
floor.
So
some things that are particularly helpful for men. Passion flower, an excellent one at bedtime. Ashwagandha, excellent at bedtime because both of those boost testosterone and lower estrogen. Now, that testosterone can convert into dihydrotestosterone, leading to prostate problems. So how do you fix that? Zinc. Zinc is a great way to block testosterone to dihydrotestosterone and also testosterone to estrogen. So for my men who get up at night, I find that for every zinc pill they get, they take, that reduces trips to the bathroom by one during the night. So, you know, maybe doing zinc citrate, 30 milligrams twice a day, can cut down on nighttime trips to the bathroom by two and allow you to then use passion flower and ashwagandha to kind of support testosterone. So those are key strategies with men that I would utilize.
So you said 30 a day?
Zinc citrate, 30 milligrams.
Okay. Now that brings up one more question.
Yeah.
If we have time. I have a little boy who I know he's low in zinc. I just know it because when he takes his shoes off, it runs us out of the house and he has dandruff. Mm-hmm. So can we assume that that's zinc?
Well, about it. Zinc works on 120 enzymes in the skin, and zinc, by dampening estrogen, protects against autoimmune issues like eczema and psoriasis. So, yeah, zinc would be an excellent thing to try in low doses with them. Now, maybe 2 to 3% of the population is a little low on copper, and so those are the individuals you need to be a little cautious with zinc because zinc can lower copper levels. You need copper for growth, but copper as you get older is a problem. So zinc becomes very important to neutralize excess copper, which can lead to heart attacks, strokes, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's, among other things.
Okay.
But let me just mention for a minute about where I'm located. I'm in Midway, Kentucky. My website is themidwaycenter.com, and I'm starting up a health letter that I intend to send out once a month. So if you would email me, first of all, if you'd like a particular handout on a topic, I'll try to forward that to you, but also we'll sign you up for my health letter. I hope to get the first issue out in December, and then we'll plan on sending that out monthly.
And where do they go to do that?
So the Midway Center, be sure to get that the in there, themidwaycenter.com, and then there's at the top, just click on Contact Us, and then put in your name and email address, and I will try to, I don't know if I'll be able to get to everyone in the first 24 hours, but we'll get to you as quickly as we can with information to help you, and as time goes by, we'll have more and more. My book, when it comes out, will have wonderful ideas for optimizing brain health, wonderful stories that are just, you know, like these little kids that just brighten up, you know, from severe autism, from ADHD, and all of a sudden are making hundreds on their tests. That's just so exciting to me.
It's thrilling. We've got about 2.5 minutes left, and unless you have a topic to fill that time, I'll ask a question about omegas. Are you good on fish oil, or do you prefer krill oil, or do you prefer flax oil, or safflower, or
calamarine? Fish oil is first. So fish oil is probably 7 times better than flax oil. So I would always use fish oil over flax oil. Now, krill oil is also excellent, and the advantage of krill oil is that it has that astaxanthin in it. And the way to think about astaxanthin is it helps modulate hormones. It helps boost testosterone, lowers estrogen, lowers dihydrotestosterone. So that's one reason it's so helpful for so many different disorders.
What about the calamarine oil, the squid oil?
Yeah, I think you could also utilize that.
Does it do the same thing as the krill oil?
Well, like for calamari, oil from calamari, you get the omegas from that, and I think that has a similar effect. Now, the vegetarian sources of fish oil don't have as much DHEA, EPA, so I prefer using the actual fish oil as opposed to using those sources. Oh, and incidentally, one nutrient that I want virtually every one of the people listening to consider is turmeric. Now, turmeric lowers blood pressure, blood sugar, blood cholesterol, thins the blood, anti-inflammatory, prevents gallstones, is an antidepressant, it's antimicrobial, has 100 identified anti-cancer properties. In India, they eat it every day. They have 1/4 the instance of Alzheimer's, 1/5 the instance of cancer. In animal models, it reverses amyloid plaque buildup in the brain. So I want all my patients on turmeric every day.
Somebody just sent me a question. They want to know, it's funny, he said, we've been arguing, my roommate and I, about whether or not you have to cook turmeric for it to work. Does it have to be heated, or can you just take it in a capsule form?
No, just take it in a capsule form. And an interesting thing that most people don't realize is that turmeric may be as good or better than curcumin. So the top researcher on turmeric from MD Anderson, the cancer hospital, and incidentally, there's not a cancer that doesn't have improved outcome with turmeric. But he says that turmeric has 100 additional nutrients beyond curcumin. And in unpublished research with both breast and ovarian cancer, he sees outcomes that are as good or better using 1/10 the dose of turmeric compared to curcumin.
Excellent. Okay, you have to promise you'll come back. You were great.
Oh, sure.
Thank you. And my listeners, I'm sure, love it. Thank you so much.
Okay.
We'll speak to you soon about coming back.
All right. Take care. Bye-bye.
Good night.